All rise.
The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary S. Katzmann presiding before court number 23-00068. Fufeng Biotechnologies Company Limited et al. Versus the United States et al. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff?
I am the name of the Saudi contender on behalf of the appellant, the name is Fufeng.
Good morning. Good morning.
Ned Marshak from Glenfells on behalf of Fufeng.
Morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Daniel Bertoni with the Justice Department. I'm joined by Danielle Costi from the Department of Commerce.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Counsel, you may be seated. Well, welcome to the oral argument. And court notes that the parties have responded to the questions for oral argument that were submitted on August 7th by the court. As counsel understand, each party will be provided with 25 minutes. I know Mr. Gold has gone over this with you. The court has, of course, reviewed all of the filings, including the responses that you've provided in this interesting, very interesting case. And this is an opportunity to address, to rebut the responses that have been provided by opposing counsel. And within the 25 minutes, if you want to give a brief opening statement or overview, you can do that. That's up to you. As is my practice, as the counsel all here know, I will provide you with an opportunity post-argument to file a submission which would be due on September 20th, next week, of not more than 1,250 words. And also, as is my custom, I will provide counsel with an opportunity here, if we're all here in the courtroom, to, some rebuttal time beyond the 25 minutes, maybe 2 or 3 minutes. As you've heard what the counsel has represented during the argument. So without further ado, why don't we begin with the plaintiff?
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
May it please the court, I am Dharmendra Chaudhary from Glenfells, representing Numenghu Fufeng in this appeal. We requested oral argument to convey that we have a right to our day in court. The government claimed that we were required to have exhausted our coal STS classification argument in our direct case brief is contradicted by record evidence and judicial precedent. Commerce in prelim results said it was following its long-standing practice to value energy cost indirectly as part of SDA expenses calculated from Ajinomoto's financial statements, which it had followed in AR 5, 6, and 7, and followed again in AR 8 prelim results. But then, in the final results, Commerce used gacha tactics when it used an HTS code for coal that it had buried in an Excel spreadsheet in the prelim disclosure materials. And government now asserts that we needed to have ignored Commerce's own words and actions to anticipate this policy reversal. Commerce's bad faith actions are self-evident from its decision to reject our evidence that we properly placed on the record for use in direct valuation of coal and requiring redactions of all such references in rebuttal briefing. Finally, before I get into rebutting government's responses to this court's questions, I want to clarify that we should prevail on our motion even under the pre-existing Chevron standard. Moreover, Loper-Bright is an important case that provides all the more reason to rule in our favor, as I will discuss now. So let me begin with rebutting responses of defendant to your honest questions. Question number one. With regard to Nation Ford and other precedents like Sigma Corp, government's attempts to separate them from Chevron is unavailing because ever since 1984, Chevron has provided the overall framework for agency action and this honorable court's review of that action, of those actions. To what extent Chevron was cited in those decisions is not that important. Further, government incorrectly asserts at pages 2 and 3 of its reply that, quote, Fufeng does not dispute whether the information relied upon is the best available, but instead how Commerce relied on this information in calculating normal value. Therefore, resolution of Fufeng's claim does not require that the court construe section 1677B, unquote. Here, government totally mischaracterizes Fufeng's claim, because Fufeng does, in fact, dispute whether the information that Commerce relied on is the best available information. And why? Because it is not only the choice of the information per se, but also the manner of its application that is encompassed by the statutory standard of the best available information. Accordingly, how Commerce used Ajinomoto Financial is properly a subject matter of the best available information inquiry by this Honorable Court. Then, further at page 3, government unpersuasively dilutes the significance of best available information by attempting its false equivalence with terms like appropriate and reasonable. Now, as an adjective, best means the most excellent. That is, not only excellent, but the most excellent choice. Accordingly, it cannot imply merely one of many reasonable data sets or methodology. Therefore, under Loper-Bright, Commerce does not have discretion to ignore the best available methodology in favor of just any other reasonable methodology. Now, on this record, given the unambiguous, undisputed, and dispositive heat value information of Fufeng's coal, the HTS classification used in the final results was patently wrong and unreasonable, and at a minimum, definitely not the best. Now, question two. With regard to Fufeng's reliance on Zhaoqing TIFO in the context of exhaustion argument, government claims at page 5 that unlike Zhaoqing TIFO, Fufeng did not have to anticipate that the HTS number for coal might affect the final results because Commerce selected an HTS number for coal in the prism results even though it did not directly value coal. Again, this argument is totally without merit. In the prelim SV memo, HTS 27012900 was simply listed, and that too among scores of other HTS provisions. Now, very important fact, such a listing of HTS was no different than prior reviews of AR5, AR6, AR7. In all those review proceedings, if you examine the preliminary disclosure materials, coal HTS had been similarly listed to 70112 or a classification. is subheading here and there, had a similarity listed in the preliminary memos, but in the final results, coal was never valued.
Why isn't it true, counsel, as the government argues at pages 5 to 6 of their submission, that Fufeng did not have to anticipate that the HTS number for coal might affect the final results because Commerce had solicited comments on its selection of surrogate values and asked Fufeng specifically to confirm that it reported its energy inputs incorrectly?
So in response to the first supplemental response when Commerce asked this question, we provided we affirmed the heat value of coal being less than 5,800 kilocalories per kg. That evidence is unrebutted on this record. No one has challenged that. And as I will further explain, this material fact alone settles this issue of HTS classification, because that remains undisputed regardless of the coal test certificates and their rejection. This fact that Fufeng's bituminous coal had a calorific value, gross calorific value less than 5,800 kilocalories per kg, that settles its classification issue under 270119. So I think, but the main, the issue as to why Fufeng did not address in case brief about the listing of HTS, because, and again, I will explicate it further, because Commerce had a long-standing normal practice normalized over 3 to 4 reviews. And under those of valuing coal indirectly. And even otherwise, the precedent is unambiguous and settled that when coal heat value is less than 5,833 kilocalories per kg, its classification is universally under 270119 by operation of subheading note 2 to chapter 27. This has been, this court, honorable court has decided, agency has decided, there has been no daylight about this issue. So given this normal practice of never valuing coal directly, and the fact that HTS heading was of coal based on these facts was settled, Fufeng did not anticipate and had no opportunity to anticipate that Commerce will switch gears and therefore Fufeng had to affirmatively argue this point in its case. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
So continuing further, so HTS heading was simply listed, which was, situation was not different from prior reviews. This time also, after listing coal HTS, Commerce, very importantly, Commerce affirmed, it listed. And then what did Commerce do? It affirmed it was not going to value coal and followed up what it said. It actually did not value in prelim results. Thus, Fufeng had to be endowed with an extraordinary ability of foresight, guesswork, anticipation to divine that Commerce, notwithstanding its proclamation to the contrary, was going to reverse its long-standing practice and this time value coal directly, but much less select a HTS heading that was contradicted by record evidence. Now, on this issue, government's reliance on boomerang is distinguishable. Because in Boomerang, the respondent had addressed only the principal argument, but not the subsidiary argument that it tried to raise for the first time before this honorable court. In this case, on the other hand, Fufeng, in its rebuttal brief, raised both its principal argument, that is, the department should not value coal directly, but indirectly, and also the subsidiary argument that should the department decide to value coal, it should select 270119 instead of 270129000. Both principal and subsidiary arguments were raised in Fufeng's rebuttal brief, and the subsidiary argument was improperly redacted by the agency. Therefore, in fact, Fufeng exhausted fully both the arguments. So Boomerang is distinguishable. But let's assume for a second that Fufeng failed to exhaust, then what happens? In that case, also, Fufeng's situation is covered by this court's decision in ABB, which was later affirmed by CAFC, where failure to exhaust was waived. Like in ABB, here too, Commerce had a normal practice to indirectly value energy inputs as part of SGA ratios when using Ajinomoto financial statement through AR-567. Therefore, like ABB, before deviating from its normal practice, Commerce was obligated to do two things, to provide adequate notice by doing two things. By not only explicitly stating that it was going to diverge from its normal practice, but by also explaining the ramifications of this divergence. Commerce chose to do neither of these. Therefore, even assuming that FUSEN did not fully exhaust its arguments, the court should waive it and consider the issue on merits. This waiver is further compelled because valuation of coal is based on the HTS classification of coal, which, based on undisputed record evidence that heat value is less than 5,800 kilocalories per kg, merits classification of FUSEN's coal under HTS 270119. Therefore, under Federal Circuit's Garcon decision, there being no dispute about the underlying facts, FUSEN's coal is classified under 270119 as a matter of law. And notably, question of law is a recognized exception to failure to exhaust. Therefore, for this additional reason, FUSEN's arguable lack of exhaustion should be waived and its coal HTS arguments should be considered on merits by this honorable court.
Mm-hmm.
Question 3. About coal dust surge, which is about Commerce's abuse of discretion in rejecting coal dust surge. Now, the chart on the coal dust certificates FUSEN submitted entailed a straightforward mathematical analysis. For each coal dust certificate in that Excel spreadsheet, the chart provided detailed specs of that coal, including its gross calorific value. Now, under subheading 2 to Chapter 27, bituminous coal of heat value equal to or exceeding 5,833 kilocalories per kg is classified under 270112. Otherwise, it is classified under 270119. Now, in FUSEN's coal test chart, that big spreadsheet where there were thousands of line items, all Commerce had to do was one thing. And what it was? Commerce had to click on the filter that was attached to the column on gross calorific heat value. You just had to click, make it click. Then what would happen upon clicking? You will see the lower bookend and higher bookend of the heat value that are listed in that column. And Commerce would then have instantly recognized that not even one of those thousands of coal test certs supported classification under HTS 270119000. It was indeed a compelling corroborating evidence that Commerce repeatedly tried to escape from. Government at page 6 claims, quote, "We cannot say whether had Commerce considered this evidence to have used a different surrogate value," unquote. In fact, we can say that had Commerce considered this evidence, it would have used SV based on HTS 270119. It would have seen the plethora of evidence that would have required HOS not different than 270119. Question 3B. Whether accepting this certificate would have delayed presents or finals? No. May 27, 2022 submission of coal test certificates was based on the previous preliminary deadline of June 26. Commerce subsequently extended the prelim results, which were published on August 2nd, and final results were published next year in February 2023. Therefore, consideration of this evidence would not have delayed either the preliminary or the final results. Question 4. With regard to additional precedent similar to chloroiso, government cites to activated carbon as an additional precedent. But financials used in both chloroiso and activated carbon are distinguishable from Ajinomoto financial in terms of their layout. In Ajinomoto Financial, there was no note for cost of sales. And we know cost of sales encompasses material, labor, and energy, that is MLE. Further, in Ajinomoto Financial, energy cost was not separately itemized anywhere. Instead, in Ajinomoto, there was a line item under note for SGA, administrative and other expenses, wherein energy cost was likely included but could not be isolated. Given this fact situation, satisfaction of three criteria, there being no cost of sales line item in Ajinomoto Financial, energy line item not being itemized anywhere, and there being a basket category line item, administrative and other expenses, falling under SGA side of the financial statement, where energy cost was likely included, but it could not be disaggregated therefrom. Based on the satisfaction of these three prongs, Commerce was required to follow its long-standing precedent of valuing energy cost indirectly as part of SGA expenses, which was established in citric acid line of cases in 2009, and thereafter has been consistently followed in a plethora of cases which we have cited in our briefs. In contrast, in both chloroiso and activated carbon cases, unlike Ajinomoto, the financial statement had a note on cost of sales. In chloroiso, under that cost of sales note, there was a hybrid line item capturing cost of energy and other expenses, light, janitor, etc., which Commerce allocated to energy. But chloroiso should not control the allocation of Ajinomoto's line item, administrative and other expenses, because this line item in chloroiso, in Ajinomoto, is not under cost of sales. And further, this line item, unlike chloroiso line item, is predominantly a non-energy cost line item because it comprises of administrative and other expenses had energy-related and non-energy-related expenses. Therefore, it is predominantly a non-energy cost line item. In activated carbon case, Commerce allocated cost of sales to energy as per its ordinary practice. In other words, there was no hybrid nature line item in Ajinomoto Financial from which energy had to be first isolated before allocating it to energy column. In both cases, chloroiso and activated carbon, after allocating a well-recognized or predominantly energy-based line item to energy column, Commerce properly valued energy FOPs based on the SB data. Thus, activated carbon and chloroiso are based on distinguishable facts and are not controlling. Now, switching gears, question 5, about 301. Government replies that to support extension of Borusan rendered in the context of 232 duties to Section 301 situation, government fails to provide any rationale. It simply asks that this code follow Shanghai, Tainai, and Jinko Solar. But 232 is distinguishable from 301 because 232 addresses national security concerns, while 301 serves a trade-related remedial purpose. And notably, both Shanghai Tainai and Jinko Solar, and I had an opportunity to argue for Jinko Solar, Jinko Solar sidestepped analysis of 301 duties under the Wheatland framework. That is, whether 301 is an ordinary or a special duty, or whether 301 is permanent or temporary. Therefore, this honorable court should take a fresh look at this.
Counsel, looking at the specific text of the proclamation here, imposing the 301 duties, how is your case helped by the specific text of the instrument, you know, of the proclamation imposing the 301 duties? What is the impact of the relationship between the proclamation and the text of the statute?
So, I think Your Honor is alluding to the fact that language, in addition to that language, you
right.
have honored. So that language is not unique to imposition of 301. That language is the same language which was used in imposing ADD and CVD. The language of the text of those statutes also is similarly worded, in addition to. And notwithstanding that fact, those duties have not been deducted from the U.S. gross sale price. So the important thing to recognize is the Wheatland framework. Mm-hmm. What is the nature of duty? What is the essential nature of the duty? Whether it is trade, serves a trade remedial purpose, and we submit that yes, 301 serves a trade remedial purpose.
I mean, can you conceive of any duty imposed pursuant to Section 301 that would not serve a trade-related remedial purpose?
No, I cannot conceive of that situation, because 301 is imposed on bad behavior of Chinese government or Chinese industries with regard to IPR theft, etc. But the total impact is on the U.S. domestic industry, and therefore the target of 301 duty is goods. The goods that are imported from China because of bad behavior, it is somewhat akin to subsidy. If that is the closest parallel I can think of. So subsidy, bad behavior of the Chinese government, alleged bad behavior of Chinese government, and similarly here through an alleged policy of Chinese government, which allegedly results in some loss to the U.S. domestic industry because of theft of IPR, etc. So, but the target of this bad behavior is ultimately the burden is felt on the goods that are being imported. So yes, so just as CVD is not being deducted from U.S. gross sale price under those circumstances, therefore similarly, because 301 is akin to 232, it should likewise not be deducted from U.S. gross sale price.
So it's your view that you could not conceive of any duty that's imposed pursuant to 301 that would not serve a trade-related remedial purpose?
Because the manner in which 301 is implemented, 301 duties are imposed on goods. They are not a type of punishment which is meted outside of the framework of importation of goods.
Mm-hmm.
So I do see a direct nexus of 301 with the trade remedial purpose, because ultimate beneficiary is also the U.S. domestic industry.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are the ones who ultimately, just as in the context of ADD and CVD. So of course, nothing, the two cannot, are not identical, but this is the closest, if we have to, as opposed to 232, which addresses an entirely different type of national security concerns, one can understand that those slightly have a different nature.
So going back to Borisov, which you mentioned you have some intimate familiarity with, should the court what should the court make of the Federal Circuit's application in Borisov of the proclamation-specific approach? Is that approach irrelevant to the Section 301 context?
I think that this honorable court should prefer the Wheatland framework,
mm-hmm.
rather than the Borisov framework when it is analyzing 301 duties. Because the Wheatland framework of safeguard duty, that is more close to the issue of imposition of 301 duties. And as between Borisov and Wheatland framework provides a more compelling rationale to decide how to impose and how to address the deduction of 301 duties from U.S. gross sale price.
Thank you.
Question six.
You're beyond time, but I will give you maybe two more minutes.
Okay. So about Loper. Loper further supports Fufeng's arguments on all issues. For coal valuation, the post-Loper interpretation of the best available information standard cannot support Commerce's direct valuation of coal input when it results in an actual distortion of margins instead of a presumed distortion under the old methodology. Further, under Loper, Commerce is not accorded with discretion to select a HTS heading that does not cover the code input. For 301 duties, government claims that LOPA supports deduction of 301 duties because the statute states that they are in addition to any other duty imposed. However, as I noted, similar statutory language authorizes collection of ADD and COD duties, which are not deducted from U.S. sale price. Thus, government's interpretation is not supported by LOPA. Question 7, government's argument that its change practice is supported by Hughes Court is without merit, because in Hughes Court, when dealing with major input rules, government simply, commerce simply added market price as a third option, which it was allowed to do by statute. On the other hand, the practice of directly valuing coal under an incorrect HTS heading is not supported by the best available information standard. Government, further government citation of Boomerang for its best precedent on exhaustion issue is likewise distinguishable, which I have already explained. Question 8, I have nothing to add further. That concludes my affirmative presentation.
And I have just one final question, and then circling back actually to the Best Mattresses case. Could you speak further to your disagreement with the outcome that this court reached in Best Mattresses?
And that is, I have to check the question, Your Honor.
Right, that's not actually a question that's specifically asked here. It's a supplemental question that I wanted to ask. Yeah.
This is a question to the government side?
No, this is a separate question. This is a new question that I'm asking you.
Yeah, so this question was...
responded regarding, in your responses, regarding your view of Best Mattresses. And I just wanted to give you an occasion to elaborate further on your disagreement with the outcome that this court reached in Best Mattresses. Let me find it.
Okay, question 4, yeah.
All right. All right, question 4.
So differential pricing issue is right now before the CFC, and a couple of leading cases going on, STUP and also Mid-Continent. Mm-hmm. Mid-Continent, we have been involved directly in that case. So this issue is a live issue, which will be now the post-local framework will be relevant to deciding this case, because differential pricing analysis coherency test has myriad flaws, both factual and legal, and none of the underlying tests which coherency requires, numerosity, normality, and homogeneity, none of the three criteria are satisfied in any of the cases that we are briefing these days. The department applies differential pricing test without first evaluating whether those three threshold criteria are being satisfied or not. Therefore, it is clear that this issue should be kept live, and more so in the post-LOPA era, where this issue is not going to be simply buried under the carpet just based on storied discretion afforded to the to the department. So therefore, I'm going to submit that yes, this challenge will be continued, should be continued.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll hear from the government, Department of Justice, Mr. Bertone. Thank you. We've added 3 minutes to your time if you need it.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. I'll begin simply by going through the court's questions to the plaintiff and giving our responses. In the first question, the court asked about the notice and the HTS number and whether Fufeng was on adequate notice by the inclusion of that number in the preliminary results. And Fufeng says that no, it was not. Makes this argument about being sandbagged by buried information. And just now, counsel for Fufeng has argued that Commerce's past practice in the previous administrative reviews of including these HTS numbers but then not using them in direct valuation somehow excuses it from actually looking at the record and seeing that the numbers were there when it had a challenge that it wanted to make to them. We would point out that first during the review process, Commerce asked about Fufeng's energy inputs on 4 separate occasions, and both Fufeng and CP Kelco had submitted responses, including HTS numbers that they proposed for coal. At that point, Fufeng had presented on March 31st, 2022, Fufeng proposed the number of 270119, which it argues is the correct number. Then when the preliminary decision memo came out, including these numbers with which Fufeng disagreed, Fufeng had, of course, all the information it needed at that point to challenge that selection of the HTS number, simply because Fufeng assumed that Commerce would not make use of that. Doesn't mean that Fufeng is excused from having to raise a challenge when it has that challenge.
I mean, put another way, I suppose, the question would be, why would it have been a reasonable use of time and resources for Fufeng to challenge Commerce's selection of HTS 270112900 in its case brief at a time when Commerce had not yet indicated its intention to use that code to directly value coal? Wouldn't such a challenge have been moot before Commerce's announcement decision to use the code to directly value coal?
We don't believe so, Your Honor. First, we would point to the fact that Commerce asked for information about energy inputs on 4 occasions, and Fufeng also showed that it was paying attention and it tried to submit untimely factual information related to coal on 2 separate occasions as well. That demonstrates that Fufeng was expending effort to, in an attempt at least, an untimely attempt to present Commerce with information related to coal, so that when Fufeng saw an HTS number that it presumably disagreed with, it should have been completely on notice at that point that it would be a worthwhile attempt to now make a timely argument in its case brief about the selection of that HTS number. So I don't know if the court is. I just want to make sure the court is not confusing the issue that Fufeng has tried to muddy the question of whether Commerce is directly valuing coal and whether Commerce is using a specific HTS number. So just to be absolutely clear, that Fufeng certainly did not have notice that their direct valuation was not at issue was at issue in the preliminary memo, but it did have notice of the HTS number. So we would not expect Fufeng to challenge direct valuation before Commerce did so in the final memo. But that HTS number was present in the preliminary memo and, you know, remained unchanged. Fufeng had that opportunity to challenge it in its case brief and chose not to.
Mm-hmm. As you point out, the direct valuation question, at pages 5 to 6 of your response to the court's questions, you state that the preliminary results did not propose directly valuing coal. How is Fufeng to know that direct valuation of coal was on the table? I think you've answered that question, but I just want to make sure that I understand your answer.
Yes, Your Honor. Fufeng was, I suppose, not to know that Commerce in this specific proceeding was definitely going to make a choice to directly value coal. However, Fufeng should have been aware that when Commerce has inadequate information to directly value factors of production, it is Commerce's practice to do so, and that this is always a possibility. And this is where we do point to the boomerang tube case, where, you know, if there is as my colleague presented, a larger argument and a subsidiary argument, the parties are required to raise those arguments when they are available and able to be made. The HTS argument Fufeng could have made in its case brief and chose not to. The direct valuation argument, we agree, Fufeng could not have raised that until the rebuttal brief. So Fufeng did not raise the HTS number argument when it had the chance, which is why we believe Boomerang 2 should govern the question of exhaustion in this case. So turning to the subpart A, I think this is what we've been talking about already, of question one, where the court asks, assuming that there was not adequate notice, could they have had notice besides considering direct valuation of the input? Again, we think that this is important to distinguish the two arguments that Fufeng was required to make. One about the choice of the HTS number, of which it was on notice. It had submitted a different HTS number in some of its responses to Commerce and chose not to raise that argument in the case brief. So it was not necessary for Commerce to have made that final decision of direct valuation for Fufeng to have been, you know, on notice if that argument was possible or was available to it. To turn to question number two, regarding the duties, Fufeng is arguing that there'd be a double counting issue if these Section 301 duties were deducted as well as anti-dumping duties. It's of course true that when United States import duties are deducted pursuant to Section 1677B, that can change a dumping margin. But the purpose, that simply is the effectuation of the purpose of that section, which is to set the U.S. price to the correct number in the assumption that the producer has adjusted its price to account for the duties. Fufeng is arguing for the use of Wheatland tube rather than Borasan as this court's guiding principle. We would point out that Borasan was not based on any sort of proclamation about what Section 232 means specifically. In fact, the court in Borasan specifically says that it is not making a distinction between Section 232 and 201 duties writ large. The court was simply looking at the language of the statute implementing 232 duties in addition to existing duties. And that's why other judges on this court have found that reasoning in Borasan is equally applicable to the proclamation imposing the Section 301 duties that are at issue here, where the same language of in addition to is used. So then I guess we move to question three, which we touched on a little bit, the Wheatland tube issue. We would point out we don't disagree with the result of Wheatland tube, but Wheatland tube did explicitly rely on the Chevron framework in deferring to Commerce's interpretation of what United States import duties means. The court in Wheatland tube decided that it would, you know, that Commerce had a reasonable interpretation of the distinction between special duties and, you know, the amount of time, whether they were temporary or permanent duties. And all of that is based on the Chevron analysis, which even in Borasan, the court of the Federal Circuit acknowledged that relied on the somewhat shaky ground of Chevron at that time before the Loper-Bright decision. In contrast, the Borasan court specifically said that its method of looking to the text of the implementing instrument accords with the, quote, best interpretation of the statute. And that, of course, is exactly what Loper-Bright requires courts to do, to look to the best interpretation of the statute.
So on page 9 of your response, the government says that regardless of which entity, you know, just to probe this a little more, acts to impose a duty, the text of the instrument implementing the duty should determine whether those duties warrant an adjustment to normal value. So, could Could one also consider that even under Borison, that an enabling statute might be read to categorically define the status of all implementations thereunder as a United States import duty under 19 U.S.C. Section 1677A.C.2A?
So I want to make sure I understand the court's question. Are you referring to all Section 301 duties?
Yes.
Categorically?
Yeah.
I don't believe so. Following Borison, it would be to look at the text of the implementing instrument. Section 301 itself does not specify the in addition language. We look to the statute, the proclamation printed in the Federal Register, which is where we find that in addition language. And that's what Borison has instructed that's where we should look to find that language. So I suppose it's conceivable that Section 301 duties could be implemented without that language.
Mm-hmm. So to the question, doesn't the statutory grant of authority to impose anti-dumping duties categorically define those duties as non-United States import duties?
So, as my colleague said, the import duties are, yes, they are defined as in addition to, and this court has recognized that those should not be, this court and the Federal Circuit have recognized they should not be deducted under Section 1677 because of the circularity problem that would result. If you deduct anti-dumping duties, you create a wider dumping margin, the new anti-dumping duties become bigger dumping margin, and that's illogical because of the same dumping duties sort of self-magnify. That problem does not occur with different duties, even if the same additional language is present in an implementing instrument. There's no circularity that results from deducting a Section 301 duty or a Section 232 duty, and then using that resulting dumping margin to calculate an anti-dumping duty.
So it's your view that Section 301 could not be read to impose a similar categorical definition?
No, Your Honor, we're not making any argument about what Section 301 itself says, but we are referring to the Federal Register text of the U.S. Trade Representative's implementation of Section 231. Of Section 301.
Okay, thank you.
Turning back to the court's questions, 3A and 3B both focus on Fufeng's argument that these Section 301 duties serve this, quote, trade-related remedial purpose. In response to that, I think we would echo concerns maybe the court expressed earlier that it would imply, or Fufeng's argument seems to imply that any Section 301 duty at all would never be deductible, no matter what the rationale, no matter what the language used in implementing it. And in fact, if Fufeng's rationale were used, Section 232 duties, despite the supposed the explicit purpose of national security, would be the same because they still have an effect on the U.S. producers. The consequences of Fufeng's argument show that this is not the way to the trade-related remedial purpose is not the way to analyze these duties. To turn to question four about Best Mattresses and Fufeng's lack of standing to assert an argument against the Cohen's D test in this action. We of course acknowledge that this issue is before the Federal Circuit in the Stuff case. However, in this case before this court, Fufeng is no more than a concerned citizen. It does not like this test, but it has not been harmed by this test. And concerned citizen does not satisfy the Article 3 standing requirement. Fufeng has not suffered an injury. If there is a remand in this case, and if the result goes back to Commerce, and the Cohen's D test in some way causes a consequence to the calculation for Fufeng, then of course Fufeng would have standing to raise a challenge at that point. Turn to question five, where the court asked about the chlorinated isocyanurates case and the existence or non-existence of Commerce's practice about valuing these energy factors of production. But to the extent Commerce has a practice regarding this valuation, Commerce's practice is to directly value when there is sufficient data in the record to allow it to directly value factors of production. The citric acid case on which Fufeng relies explains what Commerce does when there is not enough information in the record to directly value an energy factor, such as the coal in this case, and that is the indirect valuation, including energy in the surrogate financial ratio. In this case here, Fufeng does not contest that energy is present in the Ajinomoto financial statements. It doesn't contest that it's under the line item of the operating expenses line item. That's where it was in the previous administrative reviews. It's only in this review that Ajinomoto subdivided that line item into the two categories of selling and distribution and administrative and other expenses. So Fufeng doesn't contest that energy is in there. And therefore, when Commerce has this more precise breakdown, Commerce decided that it could now follow its more general practice of directly valuing energy using that line item, potentially over-inclusive, but following the procedure it did in the chlorinated isocyanurates case with that line item. Fufeng raises the distinction that the classification in the financial statement matters, whether it's listed as a cost of goods sold rather than selling expense. We would submit that this distinction is irrelevant because even here, everyone agrees, Fufeng included, that energy is included in that line item. If we're going to look for an energy cost, it's going to be in that operating expenses line item, whether it were to be an indirect valuation or a direct valuation. Additionally, we would just respond that because this line item of administrative and other expenses is put in the denominator of the surrogate financial ratio, there's a mathematical canceling out that happens. There's not a double counting. Something on the bottom, we're dividing by it. Mm-hmm. So there's not a, Fufeng raises an issue of somewhat double counting energy costs. That's not an issue. That's what contributed to, well, I'm getting ahead of myself to the question six about the results of this. So just to turn to question six then, where the court raises the issue of, well, maybe it is possible to make a couple of different calculations based on the record. Commerce has made one. Reasonable minds might disagree. So Fufeng's response about avoiding distortion, I think I responded to a little bit there, that there is a cancellation occurs, and Commerce has decided that, you know, it's following its practice of direct valuation. It was resulted in a better calculation to move that administrative other expenses to the denominator, use it to cancel out and add in the direct valuation of coal. Fufeng then is trying to add in its Loper-Bright arguments here, trying to stretch Loper-Bright far beyond what the Supreme Court had said. Loper-Bright is a statutory interpretation case. It doesn't limit Commerce's discretion universally. It perhaps limits Commerce's discretion to interpret statutes. But that's not what's happening here. Commerce is engaging in a practice of valuing energy factors of production. We're not talking about what the statute means. Mm-hmm. And Loper-Bright, therefore, doesn't overturn the Nation Ford case, doesn't overturn Sigma Corp. And these cases that have acknowledged that the statute gives Commerce wide discretion in how it is exactly going to do this, Congress has recognized that these valuation processes are necessarily fact-intensive, mm-hmm. and it's going to require looking at these financial statements in other reviews, and sometimes a comparison of different potential companies' financial statements, which company is going to be the best representative and which line items provide the best breakdown of surrogate financial information. Commerce, as the expert, determines what breakdown is best, and then that Court Commerce has discretion to do that, none of which has been removed by Loper-Bright. Perhaps, again, getting slightly ahead of myself, question seven is entirely, of course, question seven about Loper-Bright. We've said that it doesn't impact Commerce's valuation of the factors of production. It also does not impact the Section 301 analysis, because the court in Borisov specifically had said that its interpretation of 301 was the best. So there's no question there of that remaining good law. In its response to question seven, Fufeng brings up the Gerson case about the choice of HTS codes. First, we point out that the Gerson case is a classification case where Customs and Border Protection is deciding under which HTS code an item should go, and making a final determination that it is binding. That's not the situation here, where Commerce is going through and valuing factors of production based on specific HTS numbers. The case is a shaky analogy to begin with, even if it still involves choosing an HTS number. But the fact that Fufeng is trying to use Loper Bright to limit Commerce's ability to choose an HTS number merely because of that could be called a question of law is, again, stretching Loper Bright far too far, because that case doesn't, again, talk about any time Commerce interprets anything. It's Loper Bright is about statutes, not about HTS classifications.
Right. So looking at Fufeng's response on page 9 regarding Loper, they say Commerce in AR 8 misconstrued the statutory term best available information by valuing coal to a methodology that resulted in distortion in contradiction to its long-standing practice designed to avoid doing so. Moreover, Loper prevents this court, according to Fufeng, from affirming Commerce's decision to reject the evidence submitted by Fufeng, which supports his position merely because this court is of the opinion that Commerce's decision is reasonable. Now, I know you've essentially responded to this, but you want to say anything more?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that Fufeng is now seizing on Loper Bright to transform all of its arguments into statutory interpretation arguments. My colleague earlier said that this phrase, best available information in the statute, includes not just the information, but also the methodology. To the extent that is even correct, which I think we would disagree with, this is not an argument that Fufeng has made until this point. Fufeng has not raised a statutory interpretation argument in its briefing, and for that reason, these arguments would be waived. Mm-hmm. But even addressing them on the merits, the methodology that Commerce uses, the meaning of the word best, Fufeng seems to argue that the fact that the word best is there means there is somehow no discretion for Commerce to decide what is best. I think that's belied by how the courts, how the Federal Circuit has treated this phrase in cases like Sigma Corp, where they acknowledge that it's Commerce as the subject matter expert who can decide, who knows about the facts, to decide what is best. So this is the best determination is based on facts, really, not on law. This isn't the best interpretation of a statute. Mm. In question 8, where Fufeng lists some other authorities, I want to respond in particular to the ABB case, which I haven't yet addressed. Fufeng argues that case should control this court's analysis of the exhaustion requirement rather than Boomerang Tube. We submit that ABB is distinguishable. In the ABB case, in the preliminary results, Commerce had proposed a different treatment of how it was going to treat commission costs. It proposed to change its methodology without really explaining in enough detail what that actually meant as a practical matter and what the consequences would be of changing its methodology. And for that reason, this court, when the arguments were raised first before this court, it was determined that the parties had not yet waived their arguments, principally because they didn't know what was going on below yet. Commerce had not adequately explained it. The issue here is, I'm going to adopt the characterization that my colleague has done, that there was a primary argument and a subsidiary argument that Fufeng could have raised about the direct valuation and about the HTS number. And it didn't raise the direct valuation, it didn't raise the HTS argument when it had the opportunity. Just like in Boomerang Tube, where the question was, is Commerce going to use Colombian sales data? The parties argued against the use of Colombian sales data, but didn't make the subsidiary argument that these sales data were an intra-company transfer. similarly here, Fufeng has made the big argument but has waived the small argument, to perhaps oversimplify a little bit. We talked about Gerson, citric acid. Just what I would say, the citric acid doesn't, and that it does not set up a practice, but rather says what commerce does when the facts look a certain way. It doesn't say commerce is always going to directly value, or sorry, indirectly value energy factors of production. As we've shown in the chlorinated isocyanurates case, the activated carbon case, when commerce has the data to do something differently, directly value, commerce prefers to directly value factors of production. We've spoken already about Wheatland Tube and Loper at length, and if the court has further questions about those ones, I won't belabor it.
I don't.
And then about, we have both sides have acknowledged that judges of this court in two cases have now adopted the 301 analysis. So, unless there are further questions, we ask that you sustain Commerce's decision.
Okay, thank you very much, counsel. Thank you. I will, Mr. Chaudhry, if you wish to make some more comments, I'll give you 3 minutes. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor, once again. Very briefly, we were about the double counting aspect of what changed actually in Ajinomoto Financial last time. So previously, Ajinomoto Financial used to have a line item, other operating expenses, which department consistently allocated to SG and thereafter indirectly did not value energy costs separately. In ARA, for the first time, Ajinomoto Financial broke out that line item into selling and distribution expenses and administrative and other expenses. So there was a big basket. This side of the basket was selling and distribution expenses, and this side was administrative and other expenses. Now, when this basket was removed in this year, in the latest financial statement,
by the way, the counsel for the government is trying to figure out sort of what direction your hand movements are.
So it still remained a basket. And predominantly, it was a non-energy basket because administrative expense and non-energy related expenses were there. So the methodology could not change based only on that because the basket size shrunk. That is one point. Second, it's not a case of double counting in this case. Fufeng is making the argument that by shifting a predominantly non-energy related line item to energy category, and using that as a pretext to then directly value energy, it introduced an avoidable distortion in the calculation, both overhead and SG, which we have explicated. Finally, how ABB is applicable and how ABB and Boomerang are different. Unlike Boomerang, in ABB, there was a normal practice of treating U.S. commission expenses with regard to U.S. sales price, how it was deducted or not deducted. There was a settled practice over several reviews. And when the department, in preliminary results, it continued its prior practice, the department also signaled that it was reviewing that decision and it might change course in the final results. So the parties were given some inkling to the fact, very unlike in our case, prelim disclosure materials in that case, gave an inkling that something might be coming. No party briefed that issue, and therefore in final results, after a different decision was made, the affected party approached this court and made the argument for the first time. In that fact situation, the court waived the exhaustion requirement, saying that when there was a normal practice, then commerce was obligated to give adequate notice. Now, in this case, in our case, what has happened, there still, like ABB, there was a normal practice. In the context of Ajinomoto Financial, how energy cost will be valued and all that. That normal practice was left undisturbed in preliminary results, just like ABB. But then, unlike ABB, commerce gave no inkling that it was going to change course in the final results. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, commerce came out with a different result and now trying to ambush this Fufeng. And now Fufeng, when it is raising this argument, it is being met with the exhaustion argument, which we have said that does not apply on multiple counts. But even if it applies, then it should be waived, especially finally because of question of law. This 270 and 19, the code is classified under that just based on that simple fact, which under that form is a matter of law.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your time is up. Thank you. Give the government an opportunity to say more.
Just very, very briefly, Your Honor, regarding the last point my colleague raised about Boomerang Tube and ABB, just to point out, in the Boomerang Tube case, the preliminary results proposed using the valuation based on a Saudi company. In the briefing, although the Colombian sales data was included in the record, during the briefing, there was a suggestion to use Colombian sales data. Commerce eventually used that sales data. That situation is very analogous to what happened here, where Commerce proposed to indirectly value in the preliminary decision memo. During the case briefs, there was a suggestion to directly value. Commerce made that decision finally. And just like in the Boomerang case, the party made a big argument but neglected the small argument. That's all.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes our arguments. As I stated at the outset, I will give the parties an opportunity to file a post-argument submission of not more than 1,250 words. That will be due on September 20th. Well, the court would like to thank the parties for their enlightening arguments. Very interesting case. And for the briefing and responses to the oral argument questions. So we are adjourned. Be safe and be well. We remember this date, September 11th, with great solemnity and gratitude for our system of government and the constitutional protections that we enjoy. Thank you.
All right.